Let me quickly introduce today's speaker. We are happy to have with us Patrick German, who is a researcher in Lausanne at the École Polytechnique Fédérale in Lausanne. He studied in Geneva at TECFA and in Pittsburgh at LRDC. Well, I would say, to summarize it a little bit, he studied psychology and he studied educational technology, and this is more or less where he is currently also working on. He was also responsible for developing e-learning projects and conduct research in the field of computer-supported collaborative learning at the Swiss University where he is. And he's since 2013, he's responsible for the MOOCs production at the Center for Digital Education, CEDE or CEDE, maybe, I'm not sure, Patrick, you will correct me, at the university, at the École Polytechnique. His specific areas of research are interaction analysis. He's developing research methods, or has been developing research methods over the last decade or so. And I think what we will see today is also related to this, thrust towards innovation in using new research methods in analyzing collaboration. So in a time when people told us it's really too complicated to connect two eye trackers and synchronize it, he was the one, together with his colleagues, to start that methodological development. But he is also doing prototyping and software development and pedagogical design. So he's also has a leg in practice, let's say. And so Patrick, we were discussing a little bit before that maybe you can give us a more personal view on your trajectory from, well, through different sciences, cognitive science, also parts of computer science, artificial intelligence, to the learning sciences. We are looking forward to your presentation and to your self-introduction.
Thank you very much, Frank, for the kind introduction. And indeed, it's been a while. When I look back now, almost 20 years of research in various aspects of the learning sciences, and particularly computer-supported collaborative learning. I actually started by studying scripting of collaborative interaction, with the idea that you can design the situation in such a way that it is structuring the way people interact. And so it's a very indirect way of influencing collaboration by saying, let's work a bit on the tools, let's work on the situation, and then people will more or less naturally fall into patterns of collaboration which are beneficial. That was also all the early work I was doing with Pierre Dilambourg, who I've been working with for 20 years. So that was a bit the initial thing. Then I had a very interesting part, which was about studying professional education and looking at the potential of tangibles and augmented reality to train apprentices in logistics. So there we built a simulation that works on a table with little plastic shelves where the apprentices can build a warehouse, and an augmented reality system projects a simulation on top of this physical simulation. One key finding there was that if you design things, you really have to start from the practices which are already happening. And the whole design process was really done hand in hand with the teachers. And we had this no gadget approach, which is to really start from the practice of the classroom to develop our tools so that they don't hinder teaching, but that they empower teaching. Out of all that work came the notion also of orchestrating the classroom and taking into account the little details that make a class a success or not a success, and how to design technology so that it doesn't get in the way. After that, the third part before MOOCs was this GAZE stuff, and there we actually implemented the idea that we could record the gaze of two people at the same time and study how gaze is coordinated between two people who collaborate. So I'll get into more details about this in today's presentation. The holy grail there was a bit that we could automatically measure low-level signals and do predictions about all kinds of higher-level mechanisms. And I'll tell you why it didn't work so well, or in what constrained area this was working more or less. And then since a year and a half or two, I'm actually doing less research or more applied research, if you want, since I'm producing the MOOCs for the EPFL. And so far we have 20 MOOCs which are online on Coursera and edX, and we're building 10 more right now for September. There, the challenge is also really to try to reuse the insights I gained in the GAZE-related research to inform the way we produce the videos, and basically to try to the current concept we work on is a bit the presence of the teacher. How can we give some presence to the explanations of the teacher without necessarily showing the face of the guy, but rather making the presentations and the explanations more lively? And I'll have a few words about this as well in the presentation. So that's for myself. And so for today, I prepared some slides, but what I propose is that I start a bit in the presentation, and then I stop at times and let you ask questions. The sooner we can get into a discussion, the better, I think, and maybe I will then be able to better address your questions. Probably you have downloaded the presentation, the PDF presentation. Yeah. And so on the first page, you see the HolEx Learning Center at the border of the lake. That's where I'm sitting currently. So this is the library of the school. And as a learning technology unit, we also have our office in there. And on the second page, you see an image of myself that was taken through an eye tracking glass, and I myself am wearing an eye tracker as well. These are mobile eye trackers, which are more and more available now by the major constructors. And what's very interesting with those is that you can study situations in a real context out of not in front of a screen, so in a physical context. So we've been eye tracking people, for instance, who solve tangible problems like the ones I told you about for logistics. You can basically study how two people look at the same things in a physical context. The research I will tell you about today was conducted much more with they're called remote eye trackers. You can imagine it's like a screen, a computer screen, with a small camera embedded at the bottom of the screen. And this is recording the gaze as you look at the screen. This is also much more constrained because you can move your head only inside a little box, which is maybe 30 centimeters by 30 centimeters. And in some cases, we've even fixed the head of people on headrests like this so that they don't move too much while you are recording the signal. So the outline of today is that I will tell you a bit about my general framework to think about physiological measures and how they can relate to cognition or learning. And I'll do this by starting to talk to you about referencing, which is basically what we do when we say, when we point at things and name things. If I say behind myself, the ventilator up there, you know, I do a reference and I point at it. What is the effect on gaze of such a reference? So we've studied this quite in detail, and then I try to distill this very basic finding into phenomena which are a bit of a higher level, and then we'll reach the notion of gaze recurrence, which is how much people connect, how much the gaze of two people is actually coupled. On the third slide, I've put you an image not of an eye tracker, but of cheap EEG that you can buy. It's called Emotive, and it has only, let's see, maybe 8 sensors or 16. You put this on your head, and you can connect it to a game, for instance. You can connect it to your TV. You have all kinds of applications which are coming up now, where you can share and broadcast your electrophysiological state to maybe influence the movie that you're seeing, or to share your emotions with other people who are watching the same movie. This is just to say that more and more we live in a world with a lot of sensors, and people self-disclose information about themselves. I guess you know all that stuff. When people go running, they share their heartbeats. When they watch a movie, they share their states, their opinions. And eye tracking, which I talk about today, is just one example of these physiological measures. What the measures share is that they are not semantic. When you measure something like this, you don't know what the person is looking at. For instance, with eye gaze, you just know the position on the screen, you know the acceleration of the eye, you know for how long the eye stands still, but it doesn't tell you anything about what people are looking at. It's the same with the heartbeat or activity. All these type of measures are of course related to what we do, but in the measure itself, we don't really know what the measure is about. So more and more, we have sensors everywhere, and it becomes okay to share this with other people, to share it with the computer or with social networks, and that's what I call this self-disclosure of information. On the computer science side, for instance, this week at my university, we have a special day on big data organized by the computer science faculty. And of course, this is a buzzword right now, like MOOCs is a buzzword, but it means that we will have to deal with streams of data, immensely rich streams of massive data. And when people say learning analytics, this is the type of data that you have. More and more, our learners will send us loads of data that we should try to analyze to maybe help out the learners or understand better how they learn. That's a bit the goal of it. So that's the context of physiological measures. I really cover only eye tracking. I know it's a limitation, but I don't have any experience in combining many data sources. I know this has been done also under the label sensor fusion. All kinds of techniques exist to put together all this data. But my basic position is to say, let's try to understand one source quite well before we just start adding more and more data. So let's try just to develop a bit a way to work with this type of data before multiplying the number of sources. So let me start at slide 4 with just the very basic notion of different levels of human action. So if you look at this curve, I ask you to imagine how long it would take for you to answer the question, is this function linear? Or how long does it take if you read the formula, y equals x to the power of 2? How long does it take to show where the y-axis is on the graph to somebody? And if you had to explain to your neighbor why the curve is symmetrical? These examples are meant just to take your attention to the fact that in the different behaviors that we do facing a curve like this or any task that we have, it's possible to decompose the activity in different timescales. And that's what I show on slide number 5. I think the figure comes from Lord and Levy from 1994, moving from cognition to action. It's a control theoretic approach to behavior, where you describe behavior as a cascade of control loops. At the very bottom level, you have the control of physiological or very small motor actions. For instance, if I point to the machine up there, at the very low levels, I'm controlling the movement of my arm, whereas on a higher level of control, I am giving an explanation and an example to you. The time it takes for me to point to this object is much smaller than the time it takes to give the explanation. I see Julia and Freydis are wondering, is there something you don't see well? Maybe I'm watching at the chat. If you want to give me feedback on the chat, you can do so. Ah, you're smiling again. Good. Sometimes the image is freezing and I was seeing you were wondering what was on the screen. So the idea of these bands of behavior was Alan Newell. And there is a interesting paper also by John Anderson that is called Spanning Seven Orders of Magnitude, that takes also this idea that behavior is organized in a hierarchy of processes. And when something goes wrong at a lower process, you have to activate a higher process to regulate it and to fix the problem. So if you stumble all of a sudden, you have to consciously think about how you're walking. Whereas when everything goes right, you don't have to actively control your walking. You just are dealing with a level of, I want to walk to my car, and you don't care about the low level control. So with gaze and physiological measures, we're also positioned in a hierarchy like this, and that's what I show on slide number 6. When you organize behavior in these different time spans, at the very low level, you have the raw data. Our eye trackers nowadays record gaze at 250 hertz, which means every second you have the position, 250 positions of the eye. That's very raw data, massive data. Now, the first step you do when you analyze gaze is to aggregate this into what we call fixations, which are moments where the eye stands still and fixate one point. That's really in these neural levels or these irregulation levels where we are at the level of perception. And then when you move higher up the hierarchy, you get into the cognitive band. For instance, all the actions that take 1 second, for instance, pointing to an object, citing a word, circling something, that those are quite small episodes. And when you move higher. You have 10 and 100 second episodes. For instance, saying a sentence takes about 10 seconds, whereas solving a problem together takes more like 10 minutes. And so it's really the challenge I see in using physiological measures in the learning sciences is to find a string that relates the low level with the higher level. In the learning sciences, we're often interested in what level of abstraction people have in their dialogue and how the nature of the dialogue is relating to learning. But when we say the level of abstraction of the dialogue, it means that you have to listen to the learners for, let's say, 2 minutes so that they exchange about 10 sentences. And if you want to study learning, you have to look at them for maybe several days, or at least 10 minutes or 20 minutes to be able to understand what's going on. On the other hand, when you measure heartbeat, gaze, all these type of physiological measures, you're at a very low level. And it's absolutely not obvious that you can just listen to the noise that's happening down there and relate it directly to what's happening at the higher levels of behavior. So Daniel is asking that the operations in the cognitive, whether the operations in the cognitive band are conscious in that framework. I think so, since it says they're a deliberate act as the lower one at 100 milliseconds. I would say that's probably the limit for conscious behavior. I don't know. In my opinion, I see the beginning of conscious control more at the level of 1 second, at least when we study two people building a concept map together, the unit to click on a concept, to select something, that's the lower unit we use. But I guess that there might be lower levels, that probably there are some cognitive scientists who could answer this better, whether we have conscious behavior below 1 second. Okay, so let's look a bit at what happens at the fixation and saccade level. So let's start at, that's on slide number 7 and 8. At slide number 8, you see the typical output of what is measured by an eye tracker. So on the left hand, you have these spiky diagrams that show you on the horizontal axis the time. Here we go from, that covers 2 seconds, 2 seconds of measurement. And on the bottom graph, you have the acceleration of the position of the gaze. And in the middle, you have the speed, and on the top, the position. So that's only, I think, the horizontal position, the X coordinates of the gaze. And when you look at the upper part, you see there are some plateaus, so flat moments that last about 200 milliseconds, and then a vertical shift and another flat surface, and then another vertical shift up, and then a long, long plateau. And these plateaus are the fixations. These are moments where the eye stands still and is looking at one point. So you have all the muscles around the eye that control the position of the eye and keep it fixated on one point. And then you have a saccade, which is a very fast movement to the next fixation point. The very first task you do when you work with raw data is to detect these flat moments. Most often a software is giving it to you, but even there you have many algorithms and many different ways to define what you call a fixation or not a fixation. There are also big inter-individual differences in how stable the eye is from one subject to the other. Some people have the eyes who are moving a little bit even while they fixate. Sometimes they move it so much inside one fixation that it is confounded with the next fixation. So that's a challenge in itself that we won't talk a lot about today, but it's also part of the methodology we've been studying. Another issue with these eye trackers is that sometimes there is an error in the position that is reported by the eye tracker, and you have to correct for this error, especially if you study small stimuli. So on the right-hand side, you see the gaze on top of a concept map, and if there you have 25 pixels error of the position of the gaze, you have all the data which is above the stimulus. And you can't anymore say that somebody has been looking precisely at one concept or another. Or you might make an error by saying that people were looking at a concept when they were actually looking at a link. So there also, it's very important to be sure that the eye tracker is accurate, that it really reports the correct position, especially if you look at small areas of interest. Just to give you an idea about how fast things are going, I invite you now to watch a little video. I just have a question from Sharona. If there are applications searching for eye movements, for instance, to following a mechanism from source to target in order to understand how it works. I'm not sure what you mean by application. Do you mean a software application that is searching for eye movements, or an application in research? That would, can you maybe just specify? So the way we program the saccades is very much studied by neurophysiology and cognitive psychology. So there is a lot of research on the very micro level programming of the saccades and how top-down and bottom-up processes interact to sometimes reprogram the movement of the eye while it is in a saccade, because you have a distractor or because you've been primed in one way or another. So the low level eye movements are very much studied, yeah, by cognitive psychology. I saw that, Frank, you had a question.
I just wanted to say maybe Sharona could also quickly clarify her question in the video chat. Sometimes it's more straightforward if she could explain.
Hi. I was wondering if there was research in learning that actually paying attention instead of to the fixations, actually to the movement, coordinating what is in the visual field to see what people are looking at when they're trying to, for example, understand a dynamic system.
So as far as I know, most of the research is looking at different areas of the application which are looked at. And that's called the areas of interest. So people are cutting their stimuli into big boxes, and then they study what percentage of the gaze is falling into one or the other. ourselves, we've looked a bit more also sometimes at the speed of the saccades and things like this, but it's quite difficult to interpret, especially if you're studying a complex stimulus, somebody plays with a simulation, it's difficult to relate changes at the very low level to features of the task. The tasks which are used usually to study fixations and saccades are really tasks where the timing of the stimulus is very accurate to the millisecond, and you play on very subtle subtle effects. What's interesting is sometimes people study transitions between different areas of interest, and I think that would be an interesting move also away from just overall proportion devoted to one place or another on the screen, but also looking more at the back and forth and the different types of transitions from one area of interest to the other. So I propose just to give you a feeling a bit about how gaze data looks at. I have one video on YouTube that shows some interaction, some data of people watching a MOOC lecture. So you will see an extract of the video, and as an overlay, you see the gaze of one or several students. And while you watch this, I ask you to try to pay attention to the timing between the gaze of the student, the pointer of the teacher, and the voice of the teacher of what is being said. So I'll let you watch the video, and I'll be back in 3 minutes, and maybe we can say then we can talk a bit about what you have seen.
You've seen in the last slide that function parameters come with their type, and this type is given after the parameter name and a colon in Scala. So you would write x colon double y colon int. You can also give the return type of a function that follows. You've seen in the last slide that function parameters come with their type, and this type is given after the parameter name and a colon in Scala. So you would write x colon double y colon int. You can also give the return type of a function that follows. You've seen in the last slide that function parameters come with their type, and this type is given after the parameter name and a colon in Scala. So you would write x colon double y colon int. You can also give the return type of a function that follows after the parameter list. The primitive types are written as in Java, but they are capitalized. So int, for example, is a 32-bit integer, double is a 64-bit floating point number, and boolean represents the boolean type with values true and false.
Okay, so I've had time to look at it. Maybe you need to watch it once more, especially the beginning. So I'd be interested in just getting your feeling about what you've seen. Can you report a bit if you observe something special?
So as a comment, what I found interesting in the first part, where you only see the eye gaze of one person, it's always, well, not always, but most of the time, at the point of interest, but at some point, it stays super long on the double equals sign when it's about the output variable. Before that, there are only these smaller circles, and I guess the radius is proportional to the time he's looking at that point. And at that double point, it's really long looking at there. And what I found interesting about the heat map was that there were quite a lot of persons looking, well, not somewhere else, but on many different points. So they're not all concentrated on the double or y equals or something. It fluctuates quite a lot.
Yeah, hi. I found really interesting, like in the first part, you can see how most of the times the gaze goes to the point of the pen. But in the heat map, I think there was something really interesting, and was that people, like the heat map, only became really homogeneous when both the pen and the voice were related with one thing. At some point, the professor start talking about something else, and even though the pen is pointing at something, it's like everybody is looking everywhere. The gaze is just dispersed. But when he's saying, for instance, the Boolean, and just point at the Boolean, all the gaze is returned there again. So I actually found that really, really interesting. I don't know if you want to add something.
Yeah, actually, I also thought the same. And what I feel in the heat map, when what I feel the most strong thing that get attention was the pen, actually, but I'm not sure, but when the pen is moving, the people are following the pen. So what I feel like is the thing that gets most attraction is the movement of that. And also if the person says something at the same time, also everyone, most, not everyone, but most of the people's attention get on that point.
We had just the opposite impression that, so we were wondering why, or I would have expected that people might follow the pen, so they look at where the teacher will point to, but this was not the case, and it was not the case for the single person, and also not in the heat map, so maybe it's just the opposite, but maybe it was just in different points of time that they followed the pen or didn't follow the pen.
Yeah, thanks a lot for these observations. Indeed, you see it right. It's very noisy, actually. You have people who watch all over the place. And it's funny that when you look at other slides as well, at the beginning of when the teacher shows a slide, you have almost everybody who starts reading in sync. And then after a few seconds, you have some who start watching somewhere completely different, some others who read faster, some, you know, people just get lost. You have a lot of dispersion coming. And then you have seen right as well on the heat map that sometimes when the teacher does a gesture and at the same time does a verbal reference, this acts a bit as a magnet. But of course it's not working all the time, but you have the denser heat map during these verbal references, which are accompanied by pen movements. In this video, we also see the pen sometimes, which is just resting on the side. And only when the speech accompanies it, it really acts as a deictic. Some other times you have people who gesture, so with they do a circle with the pen like this to indicate that this is a deictic gesture, and so they attract the attention. So doing reference is actually a combination of different signals. You have the deictic gesture, which is accompanied also by the speech. Something which is interesting is that maybe you didn't see it immediately, but the teacher is gesturing before he is saying the things. So he is pointing to double int before he's saying the words double int. And sometimes here in this video, you see also that students are almost ready to hear what is being said because they've been following the gesture just before. If you were looking at the gaze of the teacher, he would look at what he is going to point at just before he's pointing. So you have the sequence of the teacher is looking at the target of reference, then he moves the pen to it, then he doesn't need to look at it anymore, but then you have the students who have seen the gesture and who lock into this reference point to hear the verbal reference that goes with it. So that type of things we've tried to study right now in our newest studies about MOOC video watching, and the measure that shows how much people follow the gaze, we call this the WISMiness, which is a bit, we're just writing about this. So it's a measure of how much the students are with the teacher. It's a way to measure, are you following? Do you see what I mean? You know, really, so are you following my pointing? And so you can basically measure during these referential moments whether the students follow up. We found interestingly that as well the people who learn a lot as those who don't learn that much, everybody has the same speed to answer to the pointing. So if you look at how many milliseconds it takes people to look at what's pointed at, everybody's same speed. However, the students who learned more, they stay on the reference point for longer than those who learn less. So they spend more time looking at what is referred to. Another interesting finding is also that they come back to this reference point more often. So even when the teacher is then speaking about other stuff later on, they revisit this initial reference point to relate it to stuff which is being talked about later. So those type of measures seem to be related to understanding and to some extent to learning. This effect was not discovered by us. This was studied well known as the eye voice span and the voice eye span, which means when we refer to something, we look at it a little bit before. Little bit means 800 milliseconds or 700 milliseconds. And when people hear a reference, it takes them also about 800 to 900 milliseconds to look at what was referred to. If you put these two together, you have usually a delay between the gaze of a speaker and the gaze of a listener, which is around 2 seconds. If you look at slide number 11, we have measured this in a task where two people were doing program understanding. So we don't need to go into much detail about the task, but imagine that you are reading a text together in an editor, and that one person can select a part of the text, and the selection of the text is displayed to the partner. So it's a bit like pointing. And the curves that you see on this page 11 show the probability to look at the elements of the text which are selected. In white, we have the selector. So, and at time zero, the vertical bar, we have the moment where the words, the reference, the verbal reference is pronounced. Or this was, yeah. And so you see it, the white points actually peak just shortly before the moment where the word is said, or the moment where the text is selected. That's the gaze of the selector. So you have to look at what you are going to select. You have to look at the point of reference just before you select it. And then in black, you see the reaction of the person who sees the selection. So there we had two conditions. One condition where it is spiking shortly after the vertical bar is the condition where the selection was visible by the partner. So you see something on the screen, and a few milliseconds later, you look at it. The more flat curve with dark points shows you people who could not see the selection of the partner. And this is the effect of the verbal reference that accompanies the gesture. So even if you don't see the reference, just hearing the verbal reference allows you to focus a little bit more on the point of reference. We have measured that type of coupling in several tasks. This is one about collaborative program understanding, but we found the same in a concept mapping task. This is a very low-level effect that takes place within 1 second. It's doing a verbal reference, and which is actually, I think, responsible for coupling that we observe at a much higher level. And it's also something which is related to the content of the dialogue that people have together. And that's what I propose to talk a bit about now, is to move up the ladder of timescales and to tell you a bit about this notion of gaze recurrence. So that's what you see on slide 12. So we're at a time granularity of maybe 10 minutes. Oh, sorry, Frank, I didn't see your question. Would you expect similar results if speech and visualization are complementary or provide different information? And then there was another one. Have you studied if there is any relation between where people put their gaze and what they learn? Sorry, I didn't see those. And then there is a question about individual differences, gaze for people who have ADHD. So, oh wow, those are many questions. So I think to Frank's question, so I didn't try if speech and visualization are complementary or not. If they are occurring naturally, people are very good at combining the two. And, you know, the research on referencing also shows that if you cannot display deictic gesture, you will complexify the verbal reference to compensate or to prevent misunderstanding. So I think we could maybe artificially create a situation where what is shown and what is heard are, for instance, delayed in a strange way. We could reverse the sequence of gaze and speech, or of deixis and speech, to try to make the reference work in a different way. But I think we're very, very much used to align these different signals in a way to make the message as understandable as possible. And looking at what they learn and where they look at, we've done an experiment lately where we tried to prime the people into paying attention more to one aspect of the stimulus than to another. So we had a little video that explains neuronal transmission, and this video contained equations and text, but also schemas. Our manipulation was to give a pretest to people that was either textual or schematic. And then everybody was watching the same video. What we have seen is that the people who saw the textual pretest learned more. That was one of the effects. But another interesting effect is a compensation effect, in that the people who saw schematic pretest paid more attention to the text during the video, whereas people who saw the text paid more attention to the schematics. And so it's a bit like you had a compensation effect for the modes, the perceptual modes in which we put people and what they paid attention to. So it's a bit an indirect answer to the question. we've seen also in the programming studies that we've done, so the task was always to understand a Java program, that you have very clear differences between novices and experts. Experts don't pay attention to the same parts of the program. They focus more on the data flow, so places in the program where the data is manipulated, and much less on the syntax or on the control structures. In programming, the control structures are the loop definition for I equals 0 to 10, or to the tests, you know, if then else. So the novices read everything as if it was English, whereas the experts, they jump immediately to the more relevant parts and don't look at the details. So this is not related to learning, but definitely there are differences in what parts of the stimulus is attended to, differences which are related to the expertise. Then there are differences. We've published a paper here in collaboration with people at EPFL with autistic children, eye tracking study with autistic children, where you can show that. So this is not ADHD. ADHD is the hyperactivity, right? So I don't know about this, whether there are differences for ADHD, but there were differences in autistic versus non-autistic children who avoid faces, basically, and don't do the differences in fixating people or objects. The differentiation is less done by autistic children than non-autistic. I can send you also a link to that paper. Just a second, I look it up. Voilà. So I pasted in the reference in the chat. So there are very, you know, you do that. This is also a micro study where you really look at the timing of gaze given, for instance, the onset of a facial expression or the onset of speech. And you can measure stuff like, do the children look at the person who is speaking, or are they insensitive to the onset of speech? And so it's using a bit technique similar to the graph I just showed you, where you look at an event of reference and how the gaze is moving in the 2 seconds before and the 2 seconds after. So it's really measuring those gaze reactions to events in the interaction. So, if you agree, I would continue maybe with a bit higher level aspects of it. So, as I said, on slide 12, we are at 100 seconds, so over several minutes. And on that level, there is this very interesting seminal paper for me by Daniel Richardson and Rick Dale about gaze coupling. Oops, sorry, I clicked on the wrong way. So on slide number 13, you see a picture of the initial study that showed gaze recurrence. So if you want to watch the little movie, it's kind of funny, it's very short. Here is the URL. I see you laughing, so I guess you're looking at the friends.
Oh, Monica and Chandler are sister and brother. Monica and Ross are sister and brother. Never mind.
So this was an experimental setting where basically you have these six friends figures, and you have a girl who tells a story about the episode she's been looking at. And so she says, Ross and Rachel are in love, blah, 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 and so on. And you have the people who are eye-tracked who are listening to the story. And what they measured is what I told you before, is this delay between the gaze of the speaker, which is represented by the crosshair, and the gaze of the listener, which is represented by the little dot. On the graph on the right, you see that there is a speaker-listener delay, which is around 2 seconds. So the delay between the gaze of the speaker and the gaze of the listener is around 2 seconds, which means 2 seconds after I've been looking at the place, you are also following. And what was very interesting in this study is that, and the follow-up study, is that they related this also to the level of understanding. So typically, if we follow each other, the listener will better attend, better understand what the speaker is saying. And so this is a very basic finding which shows that, okay, if it's in grounding, if you attend to my grounding signals, so to say, the chance is much bigger that we will be on the same page and that we will be able to have a dialogue that works. So into too much details, but the one of the measures, the golden measure to do to measure the coupling between the gaze of one person and the other is called the cross recurrence. So that's on slide number 14. It's a snapshot from the Richardson and Dale paper. And on slide 15, you see three examples of cross recurrence maps. So a cross recurrence map is a plot in time of the listener and the speaker. So on the horizontal axis, you have the time for one person, and on the vertical axis, you have the time for the speaker in this case. If we look at the same point exactly at the same time, you would plot a gray point on the diagonal of this graph. If there is a little delay between the moment I look at the spot and you look at it, then we are shifting this diagonal away either to the bottom or to the top. While we look exactly at this, so we have these little dark points, and the amount of coupling that is measured in a pair can be summarized by, if you take the middle band through the it's difficult to gesture. If you take the diagonal of this square and you sum up the black points, you have an amount of recurrence that indicates how much the people were coupled together. In slide number 15, for instance, you see on the right-hand side a randomized listener. So they took the sequence of gaze fixations of one guy, mixed it up, and there is almost no relationship with the speaker. Whereas on the left, you have an example of a good listener who was following very closely the references done by the speaker. As an example, so this is interesting as a measure. We've done it in our pair programming examples on 200 milliseconds. So every pixel was 200 milliseconds over an interaction time of 10 to 15 minutes. It was producing a huge matrix that took hours to compute. It's very impractical to compute over a long time, and there are many issues in defining what do you mean by exactly looking at the same thing. You know, do you tolerate 50 pixels, or is it the same object? It's quite a sensitive measure that takes a lot of time to compute and that has other methodological issues. I won't go into too much detail today. Yeah.
So Sorry, I was trying to understand the squares on slide 15, and could you point me again? Sorry, maybe I'm stupid, but I cannot see where is this diagonal. If this is a good listener, I should see some diagonal, but I cannot see one. So is that an intelligence test at the same time?
So the diagonal is a bit imaginary. So it would be, if you do a diagonal from the lower left point to the upper right point of the square, and you count how many black points, how many black pixels you have on this diagonal. And then you shift this diagonal from the lower left to the upper right up by one pixel, and this would be the coupling we have with maybe 200 milliseconds delay. So I was just a bit ahead of you. And if you shift this diagonal even higher up, you have more delay between us two. So by summing up all the black pixels on the central diagonal plus, let's say, 20 diagonals up and down, you have like a surface that you look at, and you sum up all the dark points on these diagonals, and this gives you the amount of recurrence. It's a bit, because you're not interested in all the points of these cross recurrence plots. If you take a point which is for instance very high up on the left side, this is a point that was looked at by the listener at the very beginning of the interaction, and that was looked at by the speaker very late. So at some point, once you are outside the 2 to 5 second delay, it's not really representing coupling anymore. It's like if I was measuring how much you look at what I was looking at 10 minutes ago, then it's not really related anymore to this close interaction. That's why we look only at diagonals which are in a short time frame. So we've been measuring that stuff as well. I see on slide 17 I have a nice map as well, cross recurrence map on slide 17, which was measured in one of our program understanding tasks. So this shows, I think, 5 or 10 minutes, and it's really beautiful. I don't know if you have looked at fractals, for instance, or stuff like this. When you zoom into it, you know, you have maps that are 10,000 pixels by 10,000. You can zoom in and really try to make sense of every pixel. It's like a microscope into the interaction. The thing is that it's quite complex, and that what people do usually is that they quantify just the overall amount of dark pixels as a measure of coupling. But it's much more, I think, telling and interesting to really zoom in and try to figure out patterns of interaction from that stuff. I can show you two videos which are listed on slide 16, where we show an example of high and low recurrence. So maybe I give you some time. I can copy paste the URLs.
What is this line for?
I don't know. Well, it's a different
like it's
weird. Oh, we just looped three times. Oh, look, the initial, the start of the loop is different each time. Here. First, I1 starts at 0. I2 starts at...
I2 will start at 1 and I3 at 2.
Yeah, so we take the first, second and third number and we iterate like that.
and that's the other.
This part check for winner, it actually P, first loop, P is for player, and those indexes are for their list of taken numbers, and at one moment it simply gives those indexes and gives what player
shows them, yes.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, have you finished watching them? Okay, cool. So, this is, of course, I've chosen the examples to do these videos, that, you know, the most catastrophic moment and the best moment. A real interaction is mixed, is a mix of these different kinds of coupling between the two. In the low recurrence, you really have one person giving an explanation, looking at code, and the other one gives from time to time back channels, which are actually just to keep the guy talking. So they really don't attend to the same element. In the high recurrence example, you have a very nice cascade of gaze that goes through the nested loops in the code, and you have also stuff like one is beginning a sentence and the other is finishing it. All the good stuff that we usually look at when we study collaborative learning, those distributed productions, the high quality interaction. So, of course, we tried a bit to use that type of measure as an indicator for the quality of interaction, for instance, by using a rating scheme as developed by Anne Meyer and Hummel and Spada. There seems to be a relation more or less between gaze coupling, high recurrence, and better quality interaction. This is simply because attending together seems to lead to better quality interaction and better understanding. However, this, it's a bit a shortcut then to say, okay, so we take this and this type of measure and we'll relate it to learning. And there the story is a little bit more complex, or at least relating it also to the type of discussion that people had, you know. So when we saw this, we thought, okay, cool, so we have some measure and we'll be able to relate it to what people say, and then we don't have to code any episodes ever again. Because I don't especially like tagging and coding dialogues. I think it's very painful. So our fantasy a bit out of this was to say, okay, we can use gaze as a proxy to simply analyze the quality and the type of interaction. So maybe in the presentation I will skip a little part about the methodology, but which is to, so let me clarify this. So in order to go for this holy grail, we figured that we can't be at the very micro level, but we can't either be at a very macro level of 100-second interaction. What is really happening in dialogue happens in slices of 10 seconds, or maybe up to 1 minute. People have a conversation about low levels, low aspects of the task, and then they move to a higher level of discussion, maybe where they summarize what they've found, and they dive back in again into more operational aspects. And we wanted to be able to model this 10-second interval qualities of gaze. The very low-level measures that I showed you in the beginning, as well as the high-level measures, are not suitable to account for variations from 10 seconds to 10 seconds. One meter patient. Another limitation we found in all these previous studies is that our measures of gaze were always task dependent, because you cut your interface into slices and you say, okay, when they look here, they do metacognition because it's the place where they define the goals they want to attain. Over here, it's communication because this is the chat. And over here, it's maybe solving the problem because it's a graph or it's the way you tune your simulation. And these findings do not carry over to other tasks. So the measures that you define, if you define them in terms of your task and interface, will not generalize that well. So that was another motivation for us to develop this idea of attentional map. Without going into details, you cut the interface into just many little boxes, one for each area of interest. And then we developed measures that reflect whether you look at only few boxes over 10 seconds or whether you look at many different boxes. So is your gaze all over the place or is it focused? So that's what we call the attentional focus. It's measured via entropy. Another measure that we're interested in is, once you have cut your stimulus into these little boxes, do we look at the same boxes during a slice of 10 seconds? This we measured via a cosine similarity, trying to see whether the distribution of my gaze over the elements is the same as the distribution of your gaze over the same elements. If we look at the same objects, we are very similar, and if we look at different objects during a short time slice, then we are dissimilar. Finally, we also had the measure which is called stability, which measures whether the set of boxes I look at during a slice of 10 seconds is the same as what I was looking at before, during the slice of 10 seconds that comes before. So we try to characterize gaze by three attributes. One is the level of opening. Do you look at only one element or you look at many elements? Another aspect is whether we look at the same elements. Are we similar or not? And then the third aspect is whether the regime I'm in, the way I look at objects, stays constant over more than one time frame. To relate these simple measures to cognition and dialogues, we coded by hand dialogues of the two people who tried to understand the Java program. And we coded two aspects. One is the scope of reference. When I say, for instance, in the line that says I plus 1 equals 5, this is a very narrow scope of reference. I refer only to one line of code. Whereas if I say, oh, in the function which is called compute success, then I refer to a much broader element. That was one dimension of the coding. The other element was the level of abstraction. I can speak about a single line in a very abstract way by saying that's where the winner is computed, or in a very syntactic level, saying why is it I plus 10? So we have different levels of abstraction, different levels of a scope of reference. And quite interestingly, we've seen that the level of abstraction is actually related to these three measures I've told you about. It's related to the entropy. So that's what we see on slide 24. When people speak about little details, their gaze is very much focused. They look only at a few elements over a given time. When they speak about, it's called ACT-FUN, so abstract code or the functionality of the code in English. You know, when they speak about the program in English, saying it's a tic-tac-toe game where the two players have to build a series of numbers. You know, when they speak in these abstract levels, the entropy is much higher, which means that they look at more elements during a slice of 10 seconds. We've seen also, if you look at the right-hand side of slide 24, that the similarity is the inverse, has the inverse type of relation. When we refer to little elements, when we do references by saying the interrupt button on the left, then our gaze will be much more similar than if we talk in general about abstract aspects of the task. So it's really, it's almost as a side effect that of referencing, that you have a narrow focus. People look only at few elements when they do references, and it's also much easier to have similar gaze since you are referring to the same thing. Now, can we say, okay, cool, so we say similarity is good because we do computer-supported collaborative learning, and therefore together is better and similar is always better, and the story is sold? Actually, it's not really the case, because in learning and in problem solving, at some points you have to lift your nose, you have to get out of the operational aspects, and you have to zoom out to discuss about more metacognitive aspects of the task. You have to do planning, you have to evaluate your solution, and not only implement things. Maybe I will end the presentation with this last example that you see on slide 25. And that illustrates this idea. This is from another task where Mirvais Saint-Jean did a PhD on studying how people build a concept map of how neuronal transmission is working. So people build a concept map together. And here as well, he coded the dialogue from very low level aspects, coded CMAP, like about the tool functionality. You know, what is this button about? To discussions about the concept map, which are called explain C. Every time you have a C, it's about the concept map, or nego C means negotiating elements with reference to the concept map. And the K elements are more about a knowledge-based negotiation. So it's dialogue coded with various aspects of abstraction, from low-level elements to really higher-level elements. Now, if you look at the last slide of the presentation, slide 26, you see there is actually a nice progression of the focus measure that goes from the narrowest focus when they talk about functionalities of the tool, when they talk about what is this URL tab you have on the interface, or what is the thunderstorm sign, you know, so they really talk about that stuff, up to giving explanations about knowledge-based or concept-based, negotiating knowledge, and the higher up you have metacognitive statements and dialogues. Of course, this progression is not perfect. You could say, yeah, but I have a negotiation of explanation of concept, which is high up after explanation of knowledge. This is not, this is a hypothesis. So it's not a confirmed finding, but I definitely have the impression that by studying simple aspects like the focus and the similarity of the gaze of people reflects on the one hand the referencing that they are doing. This is really the basic thing I'm quite confident about. And what is interesting, I think, is to think of the learning dialogues that we observe in our situations as being more or less rich of references. higher abstractions we make, the less we refer to things on the interface, is actually an interesting proxy into measuring the focus, the mental or cognitive focus of the people who are interacting. So that's how far I got on eye tracking studies. Nowadays, I try to use these findings to design the MOOC videos, and by having this simple idea that we should try to enhance the with-me-ness of the students with the teacher, or in other terms, for the teacher to make the referencing visible at just the good moment, not to display too much information about focus and referencing, but rather really choose wisely how much information we give about the teacher's focus of attention. I have a last video for you to look at. It's a bit it's an experiment we've done in one of our MOOCs. It's actually implementing the idea that we could display the gaze of the teacher on top of the video to help the students attend to what the teacher is referring to. So this is, yeah, it was the first URL. So if you look at this, we display the gaze of a teacher on top of the MOOC video. And so you can basically see where he is focusing at while he's giving explanations.
Alors, une première image, on est à Dakar. Ce qui est intéressant, c'est qu'on voit tout de suite l'architecture coloniale qui pointe son nez. On a un toit en tuile ici, peut-être encore de la vieille tuile de Marseille. On a un certain dispositif de façade qui permet de voir que le bâtiment ancien. Et puis derrière, on voit poindre des bâtiments un peu plus récents. Donc on est au centre-ville. Rien que sur cette image, j'ai déjà pu commencer à exprimer un certain nombre de choses sur l'architecture. On peut faire le même travail avec, d'une part, une voiture privée dans le coin que l'on découvre, un taxi, un bus bleu qui est un Dakar Demdik, qui sont des lignes fixe à Dakar, et grâce à cette image on voit déjà trois modes de transport. Bien sûr, le mode majoritaire de transport, c'est la marche à pied. On voit des piétons qui sont en mouvement, d'autres restent assis ou attendent, regardent, mais la plupart sont en mouvement.
So the interesting moment is at 2:35. That's where you see as green dots the gaze of the teacher. And so this is a bit gadget. I'm not sure it's efficient. With all I have told you about the very precision of deictic references and referencing, here you have a much more diffuse way of referencing. The teacher is speaking about the architecture of the roof in this African city, and you might get distracted by the display of the gaze. It's not very specific. It's more diluted in time. But we thought we might just try it out. And maybe at some point we'll do a little A-B test with the MOOC students to find out whether this is helping the understanding of where the teacher is referencing to. So That's what I have to say. So I'm happy if you have some questions or comments. We can spend a little time discussing. I hand over to you, Frank, if you want to.
Okay, thanks, Patrick. That was a great introduction into this topic. Also, with respect to the different levels, also to help us to see the specific relevance of the eye tracking data for other levels. So are there any questions of you, Juana, Julia, Freides, Sharona, Daniel, Özgün, Carlos? I would have two, but Maybe I leave the floor for 30 seconds for you for questions.
Yeah, hello. Well, Professor Fischer knows a little bit about my project. I wanted to ask Professor Yaman if he has conducted any research or knows about any research that measures eye tracking, coupling, basically those two things, also dual eye tracking with moving images like videos, for instance, because well, of course, as Professor Fischer knows, I'm working like those, the same topics, but in video games, and of course the video game is not a still thing, so I would be very interested on knowing if he has done something like that and maybe we can make a link, or if he knows about any piece of research that has been done in that field. Thank you.
Hi. I'm next now? Okay. I was very curious about it's fascinating to see how far you can go without semantic content. And I think the endeavor is very very important, because when we get down to the details, we need to create different tools for every learning situation. I was wondering more in a general sort of looking forward, how far can we go without semantics, and when will we need semantics in order to get to a level beyond? What are the cognitive and interactional aspects that we can capture with these more generic tools?
I was cut off during the LMU question just before, so I understood the beginning of it, and I pasted a link to a series of workshops that we organized about dual eye tracking, and I think there you will find some relevant papers and links to further to further papers. Currently, there is an interesting project going on at CMU. A collaborative project of Vincent Alleven and Nicole Roumel. They do also some collaborative gaze on Algebra Tutor that they have developed at CMU. And I think at least I know that they have been working on collaborative aspects. With regard to your question, Sharona, that I agree that it's kind of limited to be semanticless. I think it depends a bit the goal that you pursue. If you want to build a system that detects a student who is struggling with content, I think you can go quite far without semantics, because statistically, you know, it's just enough that you are at the kappa about above 0.7, and you can maybe as a reaction send an email that proposes some additional help. If you're wrong, it doesn't make too much harm. So I would say to build systems which are useful for people, you can tolerate some noise and try to train models without completely understanding how they relate to higher level phenomena. Now, if the goal is to understand how learning happens, I think there you need semantics. I mean, we see it every time we have interesting finding, it's because we coded the dialogue or we annotate the stimuli to understand how basic gaze measures relates to the more semantic aspects. And so I think both can go hand in hand, but I definitely think that there needs to be a much, much more research which is based on semantics before we can try to generalize or to apply basic measures to a situation which we have not studied yet. So that there is no, it would be, that there is no sense in applying blindly measures like this and saying, okay, it will always be related to abstraction, for instance.
So maybe that's the right point in time to also ask my questions, and maybe I would like to try to relate that to the last question. So one of our standard questions is, how is your topic related to the learning sciences, or why is your topic, the physiological measures, why should that be important for the learning sciences? And I think implicitly you just gave an answer. So the learning sciences, well, I would say overall, they have not been caring too much about physiological measures, let's say. But that also means that there is some neglect with respect to these attention processes in the classroom, or quickly identifying struggling students and being able to respond, creating systems that really work in practice. So this is what I inferred from what you just said, but maybe you can also speak a little bit more to that, to the main question. So how, why should physiological measures be important for the learning science?
So I think it's important just because our learners will use physiological measures in their everyday life, and that it will be part of their environment. And so I mean, as learning scientists, of course we study learning, but I've always thought that it's important also to be in phase with what's happening in society. And so of course we could constrain situations to try to study them in a more controlled way, but I think it's also important to do the study in the wild. And the wild today is a world where people will buy Google glasses within 2 years. It's a world where they have wristbands that broadcast their heartbeats to all their 1,000 friends on Facebook every day. And so I think physiological measures is becoming part of the digital identity of people, and that the learning sciences should learn how to handle these measures and relate them to learning. It's also, you see it with the MOOC boom, the current MOOC boom. It's really the moment where the digitalization of the world is reaching learning and instruction. Before, it has been business that has gone through it. You have other aspects of our lives. The entertainment has been revolutionized. And now, currently, you have really this focus on education as going through the digital machinery. And so I think we should really play an active role in knowing these tools and trying to relate them to the 20 or 50 years of research that have happened so far. And so from that point of view, I would think it's also the moment where we can involve system builders and computer scientists and people like this into the learning science to be able to cope with the complexity of dealing with these physiological measures. You know, I think there are so many interesting findings to be made. It's a shame that sometimes as psychology students or learning science students, we don't have the skills to really dig deep into this data, and that we actually, because of technical limitations, stay in very simple usage of these data. So I think it's a matter of listening to.
Thank you, Patrick. So this is also pointed us back to the developments in society and the digitalization. Carlos has already been asking for links of dual eye tracking and with his own work. And my question is more general. Would you have some recommendations for PhD students, given the amount of time that I know that your group has been investing in getting this complex technology under your control? So what is it reasonable for PhD students outside of these groups that have that knowledge to just use, well, these kind of eye trackers or some cheap versions of it, as you showed it today, the cheap EEG machinery? Does that make sense at all, or what is your recommendation to PhD students in general?
Yeah, so I definitely would encourage PhD students to use such measures. It's like having a microscope, which reveals many interesting aspects of what's going on. My advice would be to be careful and first really dive deep into a few logs and really to understand every single data point and go from there and move up the ladder. I also recommend not to use too many physiological measures at the same time. Data from one source is already extremely rich, and the danger is that you get lost in the data because you just collect so much data. And as I told you, it's not data that you can use as such. You have to build your own variables and build your own indicators that move up the ladder. Just measuring the fixation duration only brings you to a certain level. If you want to relate it to higher levels, I think you need a theory, or you need very good questions that allow you to say, okay, I will build a measure which indicates some concept I'm interested about, rather than doing the bottom up. If you want to fish for correlation, you will find only significant correlations. The number of observations you have in this type of data is so huge that everything is significant. You know, you have to really be able to find out something interesting that makes sense from a theoretical point of view, and then you define your measure and you look just for this. Of course, I say this, but I also lost myself into looking for correlations because it's fun to do. But at some point, the danger is really that you have to put a break, step back, and look at the data from a theory-driven way. So that would be my...
Okay, thanks for these recommendations, and also thanks for the webinar, the preparational effort you put in, the great visual impressions that we received, and thanks everyone for the very interesting questions and discussions. So maybe a quick round, if you wish, by everyone saying a couple of words or say goodbye, and then the last word is for Patrick, and then we close the webinar.
Hi. Thank you very much. I mean, it's really nice I'm deliberating how to detect intuitions versus conceptions now, and it's very nice to see how you take one tool and really go in depth and use it to discover so many different kinds of things, like the part just with the how is the gaze coordinated versus also the gaze and also the location of the gaze, and then you're doing this for different exploring many different topics. So this is a very good opening for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this interesting talk. Actually, I'm not very familiar with these eye tracking studies, but I'm always reading some. I'm studying child development, and oh, there are always eye tracking studies with babies and small children. So they give lots of input about what they can think, what they're processing. So it was, this presentation was really good for me to have an idea of the analysis and how you evaluate the data.
Yeah, and thank you very much for all, well, for the talk and for all the information you gave to me. I'm really happy because then it means by your suggestions, it means that I'm in the correct way and I'm not doing it bottom up, trying to analyze correlations, but more theoretically driven. Mm-hmm. So I'm really happy about that, and I will check the webpage, and I guess Professor Fisher can be a bridge between both of us in case I need a little bit more of help. And thank you very much. I enjoyed it a lot.
And bye.
Bye.
Hi, thank you also from our side. For me, there were two most interesting points in this webinar. One was that it's very complicated and you seem to need a lot of expertise to analyze this graph, because when we watched the video for the first time, we only looked at superficial things and were not able to listen what the teacher said and read where people look at, just follow the red dots and so on. So this was really interesting. And the second thing was that it seems a very interesting measure to find out if people actually work together or just pretend or think they are working together, because you can see if they look at the same thing. This was very interesting that you can do that. Thank you for presenting to us.
Thank you also from my side. So I think especially the thing with having this dual eye tracking and looking at those dual cases and how they match or don't match is very interesting, and I really would like to use also this kind of eye tracking in the future, but I think there's still a lot of work to be done to make that possible for everyone. So thank you very much, Patrick.
Well, thank you everybody for your kind words. It was a bit special, of course, to talk to you at such a distance, but it made fun again. It always carries me away because I really think it's great stuff to look at. Also, sorry for those who tried the first time to connect. I was at the time in Tanzania trying to do a webinar from there, and that miserably failed because of technical issues. So I'm glad it was possible today, and wish you a good evening, if it's evening at your place.